I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. When I knew Mark Zelke would be on the program again, I pulled the file I have on him in the cabinets where I keep all my interview notes. And I noticed I scrawled on the folder the date and time of our first interview. It was 10 years ago this fall, November 2006, and Mr. Zelke has always been a welcome guest ever since. We will talk now about his first book, which has just been reissued. Published in 1994, it was the book that launched a prolific career that has established him as one of the country's finest historians. Scoundrels, Dreamers, and Second Sons, British Remittance Men in the Canadian West, recounts the men who came here, their circumstances, their sometimes rollicking behavior, and the impact they had on the places here in the West where they sought to build lives for themselves. And as the break of the First World War calls them home to duty, we learn of their leave-taking. It's a great book and such a delight to read. I hadn't read this book heretofore, so it was fresh for me. Mark tells their stories, recounts the myths and legends, and talks about this place and their impact on it so well that you see why this journalist and writer went on to publish many more books on our history. Zelke.ca is the website for more. This reissued book is from Harbor Publishing. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program in Victoria. Today, Mark Zelke. Mr. Zelke, good morning.
Good morning. That's amazing. It was 10 years ago that we first talked.
Yeah.
I hadn't realized that.
Yeah.
How time flies.
Yeah, indeed. And you've published how many books since?
In total, there's 26 books. Yeah.
26 books.
Yeah. So it's the mix of stuff from smaller books for reluctant readers to a couple graphic novels nowadays and other things, but mostly the concentration, as you noted, was on Canadian history.
So, as you know, reading the books that I have to read for this show can often be a chore, but I really enjoyed this book, and I can't tell you the number of times I sat up reading this book and smiled, because some of these guys were real characters.
Yes, and for me that was always the attraction to them, because I grew up in the Okanagan hearing stories of the remittance men, and my parents were from the Alberta prairie country, and they also talked about remittance men that they had known out in the prairies, one of them famously who used to go walking through their fields, shooting a golf ball with a driving club, and they never actually, knew him well or anything. But just the humor of somebody, golfing his way across the prairie countryside.
So I kept thinking as I was reading this that let's say Prince Harry had to move away and make a life for himself. I guess that's who these guys were, essentially, in terms of where they are in the family. They're the second son, the first son inherits everything, and so there's nothing really left for the second kid.
That's right. So the second sons, and as they were always called, even when they were third sons, they were known as second sons. They had no future within the family financial structure. So they had to make their own lives in one way or another. And the doors that had originally been open for them within England were all closing at the end of the 1800s. And so they couldn't just buy a commission in the military. They couldn't easily become a doctor or a clergyman. There was an emphasis on training now, and they weren't really disposed to, serious study. So they didn't have really much opportunity, and the chance to come out to Canada and other colonies where there was a possibility of adventure and fortune to be had was their way out.
And for a lot of these men, they come here and they bring more than just themselves. They bring their attitudes, which can cause a lot of conflict for a lot of them, right?
Yes, well, because they had this innate sense of superiority, because most of them had links to the aristocracy back in England and the upper class, and they came out here and they thought they just assumed they were they were the better class than the roughshod Canadians that they encountered. And that just created this incredible friction between the Canadians and, many of who had, lower class Scottish, Irish, Welsh, English roots. Uh-huh. And so there was this underlying class structure, class conflict that was just latent in there. And then these upper class guys who, didn't know as much as they thought they did about how to actually live and survive in the rough Canadian landscape.
There's a funny moment in the book where I guess it was one of the wives writes back home and asks her parents to ask, I guess, the maid at home how to wash handkerchiefs.
Yes, that's right. Yes, that's Daisy of Windermere. She was a wonderful source when I was researching the book because she kept this lovely diary, and it was very honest about her her relationship with her husband Jack Phillips and Daisy. They had been lured by a bunch of land developers into buying this country property in the Windermere area of the Kootenays, and arrive thinking that they're going to be coming into this bucolic kind of English countryside, and find that they're in the middle of a wilderness with no development having happened at all, and so then they have to start breaking the land literally from scratch.
Yeah, so there are stories like that as well, where the Canadians got the better of the British and ripped them off, and a lot of them, I guess, a lot of the British were idealistic, or as you say in the title, they were dreamers, weren't they?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, when I started doing the research, I just kept coming back to that there were these two groups. There were the scoundrels who often had been sent overseas by their family just to get them out of town because they were causing so much embarrassment and scandal for this upper-class family. Mm-hmm. They were running up gambling debts, and they were carousing around with married women and things like that. So you send them over here. So they were the scoundrels, and they were a fascinating group. And then there were the Jack Phillipses and others who came, who really dreamed that they could have this either a grand adventure or establish themselves in a almost setting up their own English manor here in Canada.
Yeah, I got the sense too that a lot of these places where they ended up, they really put the British in British Columbia, didn't they?
Yeah, that's exactly. And that was the thing, is that the there was a sort of core British upper class that had established itself in British Columbia. Particularly in the Okanagan Valley and on the Vancouver Island here, those were the real strong points for them. And so they naturally gravitated to those areas, the remittance men, when they arrived. And then they bulked up that population and left that indelible mark on the Okanagan Valley and on the Vancouver Island. You can't travel around here without tripping over, Englishman River, Englishman Falls, all of these, place names that we take for granted.
Yeah, I've never been to Duncan, but apparently it is. It remains one of the more British cities in not only Vancouver Island, but I guess this province, right?
Yeah, that's right. It because it had this real strong. It was by 1900, it was being referred to as the most British town in Canada. And it still has that essence.
You touched on a lot of the attitudes that these remittance men brought to the country, and you mentioned the drink and just how social they were. How were they reacted to by Canadians in general at the time? I mean, did they find them amusing or annoying?
They were partly amused. They love to play pranks on these guys, like the classic ones of, when the guys would arrive in Calgary, they were always, very, very drawn to the concept of becoming a cowboy. And so the Canadians would tell them, well, they have to have, these big furry chaps and great big huge sombrero kind of hats and like Coots Marsh Banks, who eventually ends up in the Okanagan Valley. Ali. You know, there's the photo of him. He's got a revolver in his cowboy boot and stuff. And so they were encouraged to take on these garish outfits that, you know, no serious Canadian cowboy would ever wear. And so they were taken advantage of that way. They were also very much viewed as in a scandalous way. You know, Canadians at that time, with those Scottish, lower class Scottish, Welsh, Irish roots, were quite conservative. And these people arrive, they see the men and the women, you know, decide, you know, getting together to gamble and drink and party. They just loved to party, you know. They yeah. would ride to the hounds. They would do all these things that they had done back in England, and it just all seemed like a bunch of frippery to the average Canadian sensibility. It wasn't serious enough, and so there was this amazing friction between them. You see that in Wallace Sheen, the community, the Aboriginal community that was built outside of Kamloops. You know, so their relationship to the Canadians in Kamloops and around them was always full of a lot of friction and a lot of animosity, almost.
And so they bring money when they come to this country. They also bring a lot of stuff. I mean, you have in the book this checklist of what they fill their trunks with as they come to Canada on these ships.
Yeah. That was hilarious yeah. as I was doing the research on it, because I hadn't realized, well, there was this whole industry, basically, of these guidebooks on, you know, what an upper-class gentleman should bring with him, you know. And those were hilarious, because, you know, they included everything from cricket sets to, you know, the all of their hunting gear, that they had to bring certain kinds of handkerchiefs, because you couldn't get these kind of handkerchiefs in Canada, you know. And some of it was just preposterous. It was, of course, the stuff was available in Canada, but, you yeah. know, it just became part of the legend. And so they had these steamer trunks that were just bulging with all this gear as they arrived and had to make their way across the Canadian landscape.
And you mentioned, yeah, the industry of the certain steamer trunks that were good to buy, right? That
yeah.
they'd get hoodwinked
yeah.
into buying. On the other side.
And a lot of this stuff that they ended up buying, you know, in England, that they would pay ridiculous amounts of money for, and then they'd get to Canada. Of course, they could have got the same stuff in Canada.
Yeah. So I mentioned money a moment ago. So they'd bring, you know, a bulk of cash as they'd come here. And I'm Filipino, so I understand remittance differently, where people who come from, say, the Philippines remit money back to people at home. These
yes,
guys would
right.
get money from England while here, right?
Yeah, and that was where the whole thing came, because the families, when they sent them over here, you know, they still felt there was an obligation to ensure that these people survived. And so the average one was a quarterly check that would be sent to them, and those would vary according to the wealth of the family. They could be anything from just 20 or 30 pounds to hundreds of pounds in the case of some of them, you know. And so then the ones who were getting these large amounts of money, they could just live this life of complete lavish behavior, because they had all this wealth that was coming to them from England. The others had to struggle more, and that had less. But they all were receiving money that would, you know, be a fair amount of money in Canadian eyes. And they could live quite well with this amount of money, especially if they, you know, didn't have, you know, like in the Okanagan, a lot of them, they built these little rough cabins up in the woods, and so they didn't have a lot of out-of-pocket expense, really. So this, you know, 30 pounds every 4 months, 3 months, could stack up to a pretty decent living, you know, and you could certainly spend a lot of time in the pubs.
Yeah. Which they did, and a lot of them did, right?
Yeah.
So you,
and it was,
yeah.
you know, it's you know, if you look at the upper class in England at that time, there was a very large population that was consuming an enormous amount of alcohol. It was you know, sometimes the descriptions of what people would drink are staggering. You know, like, you know, two or three bottles of whiskey a day, stuff like that. somehow they managed to do it and survive.
Yeah. When you you mentioned you grew up in the Okanagan, and you'd hear from your parents stories about these guys. I guess that would be the first time that you really encountered these men, right?
Yeah, that's right. It was there. And then as I was, you know, starting to work as a journalist and starting to dabble in local Okanagan history, you know, I kept coming across more and more connections between them. You know, there's the Geesekan Ranch in Kelowna that was a very popular area, a place for the remittance men to hang out. The family themselves weren't remittance people, but they were upper class, and they became a focal point for that Kelowna community. Same thing in Vernon. You know, the Coots Marshbanks, who was a remittance man, ends up being brought there by his aunt, because she's married to the Governor General of Canada at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to figure out what to do with Cootsy, as they call them. And so they establish for him Coldstream Ranch, which still exists today. It's not owned by their family, but it's still a viable operation today. And, you know, then he doesn't know anything about running a ranch and isn't at the interest, so they hired a bunch of Canadian foremen, you know, to run the ranch for him, and he just was able to live the life of a cowboy.
So you mentioned earlier as well diaries that you would consult in terms of the research. So
yeah.
What was it like for you when you started writing this book over 20 years ago, in terms of the sources that you would consult? Because I'm curious to know how you piece the story together.
Well, it was interesting for me because, you know, it was my first history book, so I didn't have a lot of experience in how you actually go about doing this. But what I quickly realized was that here in Victoria, the BC Archives, for example, had quite a lot of diaries and letters and material that had been written by various people, and I was starting to able to just sort of weed through them and find, oh yeah, okay, this guy meets the remittance man qualification, et cetera, et cetera. And the same thing again in the Glenbow Museum in Calgary had a very large collection. And so I was basically just traveling across Canada, Western Canada, to where I knew they were able to learn that there had been these hotbeds of remittance. And so the Kelowna and Vernon archives became important, the Duncan archives here on the island, and Saskatchewan, there's a whole, it's a provincial park now called mm-hmm. Cannington Manor, which was one of the places where they gathered. So I was spent one whole summer just basically driving around Western Canada, going from archive to archive.
Yeah, and so when it's published in 1994, were you still working as a journalist?
I was working as a freelance writer here, and I just had moved from the Okanagan to the Victoria.
Uh-huh.
And so I was doing mostly magazine work for magazines like the Financial Post magazine and the Maclean's and different magazines like that, and also a lot of work for the Vancouver Sun as a freelancer. And so that was sort of my source of income, and I never thought that I would ever get to the point where I'd be able to make my living writing books, but, you know, in the few years after Scoundrels came out, you know, the landscape was financially well enough with the books that I was able to more or less transition from being a magazine writer to being a book writer.
And so was writing books always the goal? I mean, as a kid, did you always want to write a book, say? I mean, whether it was history books or because I know you've also published some fiction, right?
Yes, and it was. It was really always the goal I was shooting for. You know, I ideally had hoped to become a famous novelist. That hasn't happened yet, but who knows?
Right.
In time.
Yeah.
And the nonfiction, particularly history, became, you know, what I was able to really build a fairly solid readership that tends to come back to each book.
Yeah.
And that's really what enables me to make a living.
So what's it like 22 years or more later to read this book again and have it reissued like this?
It was very interesting because, I remembered the stories, but I hadn't actually remembered the writing style or anything like that until, Harvard approached me and said they would like to bring this book back into print. So then I went back and actually read, I thought, oh my gosh, do I actually want this book back in print? Maybe it'll be embarrassing. and went back and read it and realized that, really it was in the style and in the research depth that I like to do, and started realizing, I've really established the style of writing that I was going to do for history with this book, and that although my writing style and my writing ability I like to think is growing, you can look at this book and it stands up well alongside the Canadian Battle series.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, yeah. So we've talked about your writing over the years, and one of the things that I think makes your books as good as they are is that you make history interesting, and you just mentioned the style that you have in terms of your writing that makes these characters, these events as compelling to read as they are. As you write, do you think about that? Is that foremost in your mind, other than, say, making sure it's factual and getting the sources that you need in line? Is that your goal as a writer, to make history interesting for the reader? I mean, do you think about that as you write?
Yeah, I think of that constantly as I'm writing. I'm always, I've been working away today on a particular battle that took place in late August 1944. And I'm really looking at, yes, there's the details of the battle, but what I'm looking for and finding in my archival research right now and pulling out to write this section is the scenes where individuals had an experience inside this particular battle, and they being able to then look at the battle not just as an overview where I'm sort of looking down on the battlefield, but to be able to look over the shoulders of those individuals who went through, this very difficult 3 or 4 days of combat. And I'm always looking for that. It's those personal stories, I think, that a reader can identify with, even if they're not intensely interested in military history or in Canadian history, that being able to see the stories of how that incident of combat affected an individual is what brings history to life.
And with the guys that you talk about in Scoundrels, Dreamers, and Second Sons, I mean, a lot of them are just colorful people, and so I would assume that it's easy to make these people compelling to read because they are so colorful and interesting.
I think so. I don't remember that the book being a great struggle to write, because often their own words, what they'd written in their diaries,
yeah,
and in their letters, was so compelling and sometimes fun and sometimes
right.
tragic.
Yeah.
Like with this Phillips couple, Jack goes off to war at the end of the book, and Daisy's left back in Windermere, basically alone, and still in the wilderness. And then she gets word that Jack has been, seriously wounded on the Western Front and evacuated to England. She manages to pull together the money and be able to get to England, only to arrive to be, able to sit at his deathbed while he dies. And, so there's this, you go from this humorous story to a kind of tragic story at the end.
Yeah, and so a lot of these guys go back because of the war. And as flighty or flaky as we might think they are, up to that point, the call of duty is very strong for them, and so they go back. There's a story that you hear growing up, and you open the book with it, and it's about when they leave and what they do. I mean, did you figure out in the course of writing this book whether that's true or not?
I was never able to confirm whether it was true, and that was the story in the that you heard. I heard from more than one person in the Okanagan about there was at that 1914 there was, and we do know this, that there were hundreds of these remittance men in the Okanagan Valley at the 1914 when the war breaks out, and they were living up in these little cabins.
Mm-hmm.
But the story is, of course, that they hear from this one individual who's got a wireless set and is a ham radio operator, and he hears that the war has broken out, and he races to the nearest bar and tells a bunch of these remittance men that, you know, war has broken out, and they just automatically decide and know that it's their duty to go back to England and go to war. Most of these guys, they had connections through their families to militia regiments in Great Britain, and so they knew if they went back, they would be welcomed in immediately for the war, and they would be commissioned as lieutenants because the upper class were the ones who became the officers.
Uh-huh.
So they saw this, I think, partly as a way out of a life that really didn't have much meaning. They were just sort of biding time, having fun, but
yeah,
just biding time. And this was a way to go home and maybe redeem themselves in the family eyes. And so then, as the story goes, they made this pact where on that particular day, they all, one rode from his cabin to his neighbor's cabin, and then they burned the cabins down and killed all the excess animals and rode off to war.
Yeah.
And, of course, most of them died in the fighting. Or their older brother, who had inherited the estate, was killed. And so then they could be redeemed as the son who could then take over the management of the estate.
Yeah.
So there was no reason for them to come back, or no, either they were dead, couldn't come back, or they were redeemed with their family, and there was no reason for them to return to Canada. And that's when the remittance era, you know, largely ends. It does carry on with some people still coming, but not that many.
Yeah, and so when you look at them and this part of the world in that time, in that era, I mean, they did contribute to the Canadian West, didn't they? I mean, they have some impact, don't they, on our history?
That's right. I think one of the things they really contributed was they softened the roughness of the Canadian West. They gave, because they were interested in things like theater and they were interested in culture of all types and things. You see in the Okanagan Valley, you know, there were small orchestras and things that existed, and you know, people built libraries and all of this that they viewed as a very important part of culture, and so they added to a certain sophistication of Canadian culture in the West that would have eventually occurred, but happened faster because of the presence of these people.
Yeah. You have been traveling. I guess we last saw each other in the fall when you came in for your previous book, your last book. You've been traveling a bit since, have you?
Yes. I've been doing research for this book that I'm working on now, which is about the Channel Ports campaign, which is when the 1st Canadian Army breaks out of Normandy and then is tasked with going up the French coast and liberating the cities of the important port cities of Calais and Boulogne and Dunkirk and that material. So I'm working on that book. And then this fall, I'm going to be the battlefield historian on an upcoming Italian campaign tour that we're going to be doing in mid-October.
Uh-huh.
And so enjoying that kind of work.
Yeah.
And travel.
So do you have a book coming out in the fall?
No. The Channel Ports campaign book will come out next fall, the fall of 2017. I'm giving myself a little longer to work on books because it was, you know, the pace was a bit frenetic for about the last 10 or 12 years.
Yeah.
We've met.
Yeah. It's always a delight to talk, and I am looking forward to future chats. Congratulations again on this book being reissued, because it as I said, I hadn't read it before, and it's just such a delightful read, and you learn a bit more about this place that we all live in, and
yeah.
It's a fine achievement. Have a great summer, Mark, and best to Francis.
And thank you, Joe, and it's always a pleasure doing these interviews with you.
Thank you. The website for more is Zelke.ca. The book is called Scoundrels, Dreamers, and Second Sons, British Remittance Men in the Canadian West. It's from Harbor Publishing. Do pick it up. It's a great read for this time of year, and it makes you want to go to some of these places that are no longer there. Some of them still are, and maybe learn a little bit more about this place. Mark Zelke, its author, joined me on the line from Victoria in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.